What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Desis. I'm Arjun.
And I'm Akash.
Today we have... I'm going to start off by saying apologies, Gautam Chopra. You have been replaced as my man crush. Because I'm here with my new man crush.
Drama!
Dr. Rishi Manchada. I'm thrilled for us to have this gentleman on, who you can't see him right now. We're going to try to take a photo because I was just commenting. I have never met a South Asian that would look more appropriate in a Wrangler commercial with Brett Favre than this gentleman right now.
Or a doctor. It's mad rugged for a doctor.
I mean...
You look like the one Indian in a small town doctor. You know what I mean?
The country doc sitting there in the middle of Kentucky.
The country doctor, yeah, trying to fit in, but not really doing it.
Not doing it, exactly.
We have, like I said, Dr. Rishi Manchada. Did I say that correctly?
You got it.
Yeah. Oof.
Killed it.
Killed that first point.
For you.
I mean, I was a little nervous for myself, too. I was like, I just started talking about my man crush, and I wasn't going to say his name right. That's not a good look. But this is a gentleman who... I don't know if I would say sprung to fame for a TED talk that went quite viral.
Yeah, I wouldn't say sprung to fame. I spoke a little bit, TED talk was out there, and then my mom clicked about a million times.
My mom's doing the same thing. It don't have that impact, though.
I think we say we have like 700 listens per episode, but it's mostly just Akash's mom. I'm going to tell you something very honestly to all the listeners of my podcast. My parents have not listened to it.
We got to get on that.
They keep saying every time I see them, every time I'm talking.
We can get our moms to work on this, actually. That's good.
My mom's like, feels so guilty. She's
Tampa,
like,
come on.
I haven't been listening. Anyway, we're getting very off topic.
Real quick, last thing on that topic, my mom consistently listens and is horrified by me. She constantly is like, this is not who you are. I don't know what you're doing.
But she listens.
But she does listen. She's super supportive.
Trump effect.
Yeah. Oh, gotta win.
Jerome is a doctor. Would you consider yourself an upstreamist also?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So,
which we're gonna dive into what that means in moments, but primarily a doctor, he does a lot of social medicine advocacy. He started a company, Health Begins, mm-hmm. And he's there. Are Dr. Sony, who I'm just name dropping, because we had breakfast with him and it was beautiful. He has lofty goals for
like
this
ladies.
Gentleman.
He's a gentleman.
So we are so excited to get a chance to talk with you this morning.
Thank you. Yeah.
First question is, for those people that didn't listen to the TED Talk, which, what are you doing with your life? What is an upstreamist? What does that mean?
So the upstreamist is this term, this label that I came up with to really define myself. I didn't like the conventions that were used to describe what I was doing in healthcare. I'm not a primary care doc. I'm not a specialist. I'm somebody who really has devoted my career to thinking about what happens in the clinic walls and, more importantly, what happens outside of it and how do you connect those dots.
Would you mind telling the parable, that public health parable? Because that was really hit me in a way that was really... I just never
sure, yeah, right quick. Movies. So the upstream parable is something the public health folks know pretty well. I adapted it slightly. You ready?
Yeah.
I'm ready.
All right, let's settle on that.
I've already heard it, but yeah, I'm ready.
So three friends approach a river. It's a beautiful scene. Birds chirping, water babbling creek, the whole thing. And to their dismay, they see people in the water, children, adults, the elderly, in the middle of the water, drowning, needing rescue. So the three friends do hopefully what a lot of us would do, to jump right in and try to help those folks. The first friend focuses on those who are about to drown, just at the waterfall's edge. Everybody says, that makes total sense. By now, there are people amassing on the riverbanks. And we say, that makes total sense. Let's save those who are about to drown. Over time, the second friend says, I'm going to move a little bit further upstream. I'm going to coordinate the branches along the riverbanks here and build a raft so we can usher more people to safety. And everybody says, well, that makes sense, too. Let's do that. And there's some moderate success, fewer people slipping through. Over time, though, those two friends get a little tired. They get a little jaded. They remain committed to the work. They're in the water. They're not, like, taking a vacation. But they're asking themselves, what's going on? Their people keep on coming. They do things that are regrettable but understandable, right? They say things like to people in the water, didn't someone teach you how to swim? They start, you know, talking to each other. They start calling the recruiters and saying, hey, is there another stream I can jump into, or can I look for another opportunity here? I mean, there's all sorts of manifestations of this sense of unease about the situation they're in. And then they realize that their third friend is nowhere to be seen. They came with three, right? And they look up and they spot her. She's in the water. She's not pontificating, sitting off to the side and giving commentary. She's actually in the water saving people just as they are. But she's further upstream from them, swimming away. And they're dismayed. They shout to her, "Where are you going? There are people here to save. What's going on?" And she shouts back, "I'm going to find out who or what is throwing these people in the water." So the upstreamist is that third person. The first friend is really the downstream rescuer, right? The specialist, the ICU nurse, the trauma surgeon. I'm using this, of course, in the healthcare system, but as I've been hearing from colleagues and other
It's applicable
sectors,
everywhere, really.
It might be, and I'll just speak about what I know, which is the space in healthcare. It is certainly true from my experience in healthcare, right? We know in this service sector that there are those that you need who are vital rescuers when you're in dire straits, right? You need people to be there when you're in the emergency room, when you're diagnosed with that terminal case of cancer, when you need intensive support because you're bouncing in and out of emergency rooms or hospitals. We have plenty of those right now, and we actually need more, especially in places that don't have them. Places like South LA, places in rural America. I mean, there's plenty of places that just don't have enough specialists. We are now, right now, in the U.S., at least in the era of that second friend, right? That the second friend is who I call the comprehensivist, mm-hmm. that primary care clinician, the person who's got your back, says, "I'm going to check you for those immunizations, get you caught up on all the kind of maintenance, come in for an annual tune-up, and we'll set you on your way. This is your raft," right? So that you don't have to end up getting sicker later on, the kind of clinical preventative stuff. Increasingly, though, I think it's clear that we've always had and we need more of that third friend, the upstreamist. This is a tradition that goes back for 200 years, and I'm just part of it.
I want to ask you this question because you, in my conception, which may be false, my conception is that the specialist is lifted in its romantic, whether it's a romantic ideal, but or whether it's just a construct of society. I look at the specialist as like they are the ones on top.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, there's an importance that's given to them.
That's right.
And there's on it, and it sounds like more often than not, a financial reward that's given to them that's much higher than the other two friends.
That's right.
Thinking about upstreaming the obstacles within getting more people into upstreamists, because that was the thing that triggered me. It was like, because you had said something like, I think in the TED Talk you said that we need something like 25,000 mm-hmm. upstreamists by 2020.
That's my estimate, yeah.
That's an estimate, yeah. But I'm assuming that we're somewhat far from that, or where would you think that we are in our number?
I think we're about a tenth of the way there.
A tenth? Whoa, okay. That was less than I was expecting.
I killed the mood, didn't I?
But if we, part of what I'm wondering about isn't there like a construct where it's not necessarily in the best interest of those with the most money to have upstreamists? Because if you stop the children from coming to the edge, where do they they get their money from?
Absolutely. So let's unpack that, right? I mean, it's exactly to your point here. The first part, what's the assumed kind of hierarchy in healthcare. Mm-hmm. And for that matter, to the extent that that hierarchy in healthcare represents our own values as patients, as people, as society, right?
Right.
What does that mean? I think to that first point there, the reason that the specialists have been in the mind's eye, the people at the top, right,
mm-hmm.
is because it's so linked to the financial rewards. It's a chicken and egg kind of question, right?
Right.
If you reward a certain group, in our society, we've chosen to reward specialists in a way that's entirely disproportionate to, say, primary care clinicians, or for that matter, teachers or firefighters or other folks who you could argue sitting around, you know, having a sip of coffee, maybe there's a way to distribute financial rewards to represent the priorities that we want in society right now. The specialists get a lot more right now in healthcare compared to everybody else. So it's not surprising when you reward a lot of folks in that system that that becomes the group that everybody wants to become.
Yeah, it just
right?
seems that we
that
end
the,
up...
The Desi aunties want to say, my son should be a specialist because, right. you know, it's the financial and cultural things are intertwined, right? Those. So I'm not too surprised by it. But you were going to say, sorry.
No, it just seems that we reward the people. If we look at it as a tree, we reward people that, like, cut the leaves rather than people that, like, grow the roots.
Yeah, exactly. So then it becomes a question of priorities, right? So we do have a system. We've had a system up until now, and I think we still largely have a system in the U.S. that essentially is paying for pills and procedures,
mm-hmm.
right? Pays for those technical delivery of services. rather than other technical skills, right, which are how do we prevent that person from getting sick in the first place? Or to put it even more finely, we're paying for volume, people getting more and more services,
right,
which hopefully are adequate services. But I want to come back to that point because hopefully is not happening.
Right.
Rather than value, right? We're paying for volume rather than value. And value means, are you getting healthier or not, right?
Right.
You as an individual person, you as a community, we as a society, right? Are we getting our money's worth? Even more fundamentally, at the basic level, from if you think about that almost sacrosanct relationship that somebody has when you are sick, right? Or when you have that relationship with your primary care provider or with any nurse practitioner or a social worker in the healthcare system, anybody. In that relationship, are you getting the value, not just monetarily, but frankly, just meaning, right? There's far too many people who've had that experience of coming into a system, even with the most beloved of providers, right? And feeling like, apart from that relationship they have with the provider, that they're otherwise treated like chattel, right? They're just seen as people who are there to have people bill them and to be, they're the reimbursement for some payer.
Too many people drowning to really pay that much.
Well, it's also a quick anecdotal. My father is a physician. He's retired from private practice and he's now living in DC and just kind of taking on part-time work to just because he loves being a doctor.
Yeah.
He just really loves it. And he recently was telling a story. He had to leave a place that they, because they wanted him to do like a certain amount of patient, like 30 something patients or 50 patients in a day or something crazy. And he was like, I want to talk with someone. I would like to spend like an hour with them and like really engage with them. And he was like, there's a construct around the money, like where they treat, instead of treating people as people, it's you are, like you said, chow, like you have to get through the line to like meet my quota for the day, which doesn't allow doctors to be, to have as much humanity.
So to your dad's experience, there are hundreds of thousands of providers, not just doctors, but others in the system. And doctors, we have the most privilege. So we have the most resilience, right? To protect ourselves against that system. But think about everybody else who isn't as privileged right now, whether earned or not, right?
Right.
In society, who are also in the healthcare system, the medical assistant, the nurse practitioner, anybody else who you think about in the hospital, and think about their own, scent of disconnect, right? Like, is this, what's, something's off here, right? We're seeing a lot of people and there is value that's there. Like, you know, there are a lot of times, there are people, especially when you are sickest of the sick, when you're in that hospital and you're in that operating room, you need that. And I don't want to undermine that. We need specialists. We need primary care comprehensivists. And we also need upstreamists. It's not that it's an either or scenario, but the disconnect is something that is palpable, not just with your dad and a lot of physicians, especially Daisy physicians who are disproportionately represented, right, in the healthcare workforce. It's what I want to get to is why, right? And the reason I want to get to that is because that's exactly what I experienced from the get-go. I had my eyes wide open before I went into med school about what this was going to be, but I didn't fully realize it until I walked in those shoes.
How did you get your eyes wide?
Yeah. I'll back up. So
now let's dive a little bit into you.
I like how we're picking up on the water theme here. It's like upstream. We're going to dive in. This is good.
I didn't even think about that, man. I'm not smart enough to think about that.
It's good.
I'm just a channel. My genius just channels through.
This is flowing really well.
You notice it as an upstreamist. You know what I mean?
I'm tuned in, man. I'm tuned in. So my story, why I, to answer your question about what, you know, it opened my eyes. Parents, just like all of ours, right? Immigrants. My dad came over in 69, went back in 72 to marry my mom. They came over. I was born in 75 in Queens, New York.
Word.
Flushing.
Right. He said that sitting as far away from Flushing, Queens as he could possibly be.
Be right now, exactly.
Yeah, it did not sound like when 50 Cent shouts out Jamaica. Let me just say
that was not a shout out. That was, Flushing is now, if I was... Flushing right now is mostly Koreans.
Yeah, that's where the temple is, though.
That's where the temple is, though, exactly. And the temple was just there in the beginning stages around the time I was there. So when I was three, we moved. My dad's an architect, and my mom, she was trained, she was teaching English in India. Didn't have much of a success in finding a job as an English teacher in America when she came here. So she switched over to become an accountant for many years. And my dad got a job with Big Oil, with Bechtel, moved down to Houston. And we stayed there for almost 8 years. A couple of those years were spent in going back to India because my mom said, you know, when my dad got this job offer to go to Saudi Arabia, my mom said, you know, thanks, but no thanks. You can commute from Delhi and go down to Saudi Arabia and we'll do that. My dad, God love him, did that. He went to Saudi and every couple months he'd just go back and forth and hang out with us in New Delhi while I was there with my mom. My brother was born there. We had a phenomenal time. Came back.
Did you go to the American Embassy School? Did you go to an American school? Did you go to a Hindi?
I went to a Modern Convent School, which is an English medium school, but not American Embassy School, not the American school.
It was the Indian system.
It was the Indian system.
Wow.
That's why he's so smart.
That's well. That
oh yeah, my rote memory skills, man.
That's what I was going to bring up because I lived in India as well for a year, and we went to the American Embassy School because my parents wanted me to be able to
shift back over.
Yeah,
my parents weren't nearly that kind of far thinking.
But yeah, I have teachers. I have family members that are teachers, and I've always been fascinated by the Indian education system because it's like it turns out factory workers in a really crazy way. It doesn't seem to really.
I was fortunate, right? Like what I was experiencing was certainly the Modern Convent School was an English medium school, so that automatically set us apart because it was predominantly in English, with Hindi, of course, being there, rather than predominantly a Hindi medium school or some regional school in other parts of India with English as a secondary, right? So, and it was in Delhi, and we could afford to pay for that school, so it was still a privileged space in the Indian education system. But you know what I remember wasn't any deep thoughts about. Educational experience. I remember trading my auto paranta with this guy, a good friend of mine who was there at the time when I was 7 and 8, and he would give me his achar, you know, the really and he'd trade me the achar, and I would eat achar and he would eat my auto paranta, and it was
combine the two and share that?
Why don't you share an actual meal instead of you just eating?
You just ate a
Where were you guys when I was 7?
I don't know.
I have like massive reflux right now just because I've got a hole in my stomach created by
that
achar when I was
8. You just eat achar.
I just love that spice, man. It was good. Anyway, so memories like that, right? Cramming into it, a Fiat with...
the number of people you
eat other people
don't even make sense.
Especially if they're tiny people, like, you know, 7 or 8 year olds, man. It was awesome. It was like a circus clown kind of act, right? We just pile them in and then they come out like more kids coming out.
Was that the experience was it that experience in India what opened your eyes towards the world?
Absolutely. Just like anybody, right? If memories of then going with my grandma with my nanny over to one of the temples on the outskirts of Delhi at that point. It's now been swallowed up by Delhi. But and seeing a pundit who is there, being ready to kind of bring in an upper class family like us to say, okay, come on in, you can pray, of course, and then kicking a kid who is a street urchin, you know, off to the side that's there. And I was like, you know, the hypocrisy, not just of manifest in that personal level, but also the hypocrisy and the palpable kind of discomfort of seeing that disparity, right? It is so evident in the cities of India, especially, right? But fast forward many years, you kind of get that baked in when you realize that there's differences, that there are people who live in different parts of the world, experience things differently, that I myself and we are manifestations of people who come from two different places, right? We're in the hyphen, right?
Right.
So we all have that. That was something that I didn't consciously sense until I got a little bit older, high school, had deep interest in political sciences, international development, but also this interest in health. Went to Tufts.
Those were interests in high school?
Yeah.
My interests were NBA and striking out with girls.
I wasn't, the striking out with the girls part, I mean, I got that down cold. But so I didn't have to, I moved on from that.
I have a hard time believing that in this Carhartt shirt and this CV. I just have a hard time.
This evolved only more recently, my friend. Back in the day, man, I was sporting my rose tinted glasses that were like super, I was hot.
We need a photo of that for the website.
We burned all those.
So you went through college, you wanted to do this, you said that you had your eyes wide open before you entered this, but then you
college
fully
really
realized.
Yeah, so college was that awakening really for me because I hung out with a lot of other Desis. So growing up, we eventually got back to New York, then I went to college at Tufts. Tufts is a phenomenal school in terms of for myself, it was experiential, a lot of really great service learning opportunities. Jumped
right
in. It's
also phenomenal because it's one of the best schools in the country, but you know what I mean? Yeah, sure.
That's true. It was phenomenal. It was really good. And I loved it. So I took a course in my junior year, snuck into, it was a grad course at the Fletcher School, which is their kind of grad campus, right, for law and diplomacy. So I Snuck into this grad level class and audited. And
I just love that you snuck into a grad level
class. I asked, but it was a couple other folks.
That was a humble way of saying I was a beast, so let me take whatever class I wanted.
I snuck in. I learned early on it's okay to ask because you never know. So I asked one of the TAs for that course, and anyway, it was in the class, the political economy of world hunger. Take that on, right?
Like political economy of world hunger.
Exactly. Okay. And I was like, that's the class I want to take. Right. What the hell does that mean?
Yeah.
So I unpacked that. And one of the stories that came up was the story of Kerala, Southwest India.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this is my people. I should know this. So I'm going to start like reading the book. And I'm like nodding my head in class like, I know the story. I'm like, I have no clue about this place.
Isn't that such a funny pressure we take on as South Asians as soon
Man,
as something about
it? I feel so much embarrassment when I don't know somebody about India. Oh, there's so many things I don't know.
Well, it's so, how do you? It's like, it's such a complex space with so much happening.
So we all bear that burden, right, of having to, somebody saying, you don't know about your deep mythological kind of history. Can you give me your PhD analysis of that part of Indian culture
like
that I found out
to.
About?
We
you feel
be
like
to,
we should we, be able to
we,
do that?
We should be able to fake it.
We should be able to fake it.
That's what a lot of people are doing. So anyway, I found out about this place in Kerala, and I was embarrassed by my own lack of like, oh yeah, Kerala. That's right. Classic North Indian, son of Punjabis, kind of talking about another part of the country.
What do you need to learn about dark-skinned people for?
That was tapping into all that, right?
It was a nice moment of Akash ignorance for us all in this morning. Thank you.
Shut up. Don't try to impress this dude. Don't ever try to impress a guest at my expense again in your life.
Let's get the man crush, man.
It's my man crush, bro.
I don't like it.
I'm going to override
you're
right
not
now.
Win.
Vern's earning. Move over. I'm going to get you. I'm going
to
get you too.
He's going to embarrass his friend to impress a girl he likes. Nobody likes that dude.
Except for when I get Shut the girl up. And you get goodbye.
All right, I'm not gonna.
I'm gonna step out for a little bit.
We're not gonna,
I'm
gonna do this.
So, long story short, you know that experience learning about Kerala convinced me I wanted to go. So, junior year summer, I went to Kerala. I took a video camera with me and just met with a lot of these folks who were engaged in that story of what made Kerala this special place. Like other parts of the world that have achieved impressive health outcomes, low infant mortality rates, literacy, incredible place,
literacy.
Crazy, right? Yeah. Crazy. And at that point, at least one of the poorest, I think it was the second poorest state for many years in India, right?
Yeah.
So it's not that it defied the logical model that we had been brought to believe in this part of the hyphen, right? In the U.S. experience, which is you get the two cars, the 3.5 kids, and the mortgage, and then that's how you get healthy, right?
Right.
Right.
So something was odd about that. It was an anomaly from my reference point. And so I went, and then I got hooked, and I wanted to learn more. So after college, I got a job with a nonprofit organization in Delhi, and for a year worked in unpacking that a bit more, learning and just traveling around. I spent like 5-6 weeks at a time in Orissa, in Himachal Pradesh, in Maharashtra, and then in Kerala with different NGOs, the nonprofits, right? And just hanging and asking specific questions around what they were doing with health that was different, especially in the context of the political environment in India. And at that point, India had was just a few years into this experiment called Panchayati Raj. Panchayat system, the five elders. Mm-hmm. It's a village democracy.
Oh, I didn't know about this.
So this is my education, right? So the panchayats were and still are in many villages the local governing structure, usually five elders, mostly men, mostly upper caste in that society, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just Gandhi was a big proponent of this when the time of independence came. Other folks, especially folks who are not so enamored with the idea of five elders, you know, who were from upper caste systems, you know, dominating, weren't so hot about that, which is why, and Nehru and others kind of won the centralized model of Indian democracy. Fast forward 50, almost 60 years later, Rajiv Gandhi, no relation, right? Said, we're going to make this Gandhian style experiment kind of happen. We're going to devolve power to the panchayats. So we're going to try to give all the states the ability to do panchayati raj, rule by panchayats. And so the big question was, how is this dramatic political reform? Think about what that would mean in the U.S., right? It's essentially even more powerful decentralization, right, to local village or local town councils. How would that manifest in terms of improvements in people's lives? That was my question.
Right.
And that year was an eye-opening experience because I met people who were role models, who happened to be change agents, so, you know, social workers and community health workers, some who happened to be doctors too. And I said, that's it. That's the type of doctor I want to be. Mm-hmm. I want to be somebody who's connected with people directly. So no matter what, all the noise, all the politics, all this macro analysis, that can go away. But at the very least, I got that connection.
Right.
But maybe I can be someone who's engaged in a broader the fabric of a community and be involved in these things. So it was a phenomenal experience. I came back and
well that's let's what got talk me about that moment of coming back. I was wondering, you spent a lot of time, you had a very, it sounds like, transformative experience from 7 to 9 there. You went back at this and had this year that you, where you learned a lot, met a lot of your role models. Was there a desire, was there a question of staying there and making your life there?
No, yeah, I thought about that, but it was a quick answer, right? As much as I'm talking about the seven ages of 7 to 9 and then the year in India, the majority of my life was spent hanging out in part of it in Texas at Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah.
Part of it was in Jersey and then New York and hanging out here. So I knew, as I think a lot of us know, when you go to India, you're like, damn, I'm American. Yeah, and you come over here, you're like, oh, I'm kind of Indian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was abundantly apparent to me when I was out there. I knew that home was here, right, in the U.S., where my parents had made a home. And
how connected were you to India when you were in America, and how much did your parents impress that upon you? Like, you need to be, you're Indian, you need to connect with that. Because you made a choice in college to go back to India for a year, and, like, you had that feeling, like, I need to know this.
Yeah, they weren't, my parents are not cultural zealots by any means, right? Or right. religious ones at all. They weren't saying, look, this is what it means now, Berta, to be Indian, you have to do X, Y, and Z, you have to do this ritual, they have to go to this cultural event. It was mostly, it was the exact opposite. It was, let's spend our weekends going and hanging out with families, you know, people that we connect with. It wasn't mm-hmm. driven by any kind of cultural zealotry. It was driven by just connection, right? Let's just go out and spend our weekends driving 4 hours to hang out with other Desis that we knew through 3 degrees of separation, right? And so my experiences were growing up just hanging out on many weekends
right.
in the backseat of a car, passed out while my parents were driving back at 4 a.m. from playing cards all night with their friends, right?
Did you connect with those people? Did you find, was it easy for you to fit in amongst that community, or did you ever feel?
I think we all had that kind of experience of just being, this is again in Texas, and afterwards, you know, everybody felt like they were part of something, we were different, and then we'd go back in the weekdays to our lives in school or wherever. And then in college is when the critical mass of people I found, really, enough Desis like myself, enough ABCDs, right? Where the C started to go away, right? Part of the confusion in the ABCD kind of acronym, right, comes from feeling isolated, alone, like your experience is just yours.
Yeah.
Right? But once you bring enough people together, the confusion at least went away for me.
Man, that was dope.
Yeah. So you would say that while you were in college, you had a large Desi community. Would you say that most of your friend circle was quite? I found that the tendency is there that you either have only brown friends. Or you have very few brown friends. Would you say that you fell in that? What point in that spectrum did you fall?
I had, I haven't thought about it in a while. I would say
you ask those hard questions here.
You
on
guys
American
are deep,
Desis.
Man. This is. I'm gonna start to tear up. Like my Oprah moment here. I think it was an even mix, but it varied, right? So it varied depending on my need, right, and the need of my friends around me. So the answer was always both, right? It was never like I intentionally chose or was chosen to be part of one group or the other. But that was the luxury and the privilege of being in a college environment where you have 4 years to just start to flow back and forth between different identities. Yeah. And, you know, being able to say, one day I'm going to wear that Carhartt. I used to wear these blue overalls. Actually, I did have this back in the day. Blue overalls.
Wow.
Do it. Oshkosh.
Oshkosh overalls.
Do it. You know, I did in college. I had friend circles of, like, I lived with all black people. I had a group of all Indian friends.
Right.
I was friends with a couple white people. Not that many. A couple white people. But I would never really want them to mix. I would always be like, if I'm hanging out with my Indians, like, I'm connecting with my people. I don't, like, my roommates.
That's
are
right.
Like, you can just stay there. Like, you're good at the apartment. I'm here connecting with my people right now.
Yeah. Same experience. I think that what was fun sometimes was seeing how those things kind of came together, and then realizing that you can sometimes be that you were that connector,
right?
Yeah, when that would overlap, you didn't want to.
No, I didn't care.
I love that because it was a small enough campus. You know, the people there was enough. It wasn't so large where there was tribes, right?
Right.
With well demarcated kind of boundaries of saying, are you in or are you out?
Yeah, Tufts is a pretty small school, right?
It was small enough, and you know, I was able to. Walk across those without even realizing that there had to be strict boundaries. And part of it was because I didn't really fit in 100% into the true Desi experience. Like, I have to declare my national kind of pride in the, you know, being an Indian national.
Right.
Got involved with the South Asian group on campus there. It was called TASA, the Tufts Association of South Asians.
Yeah.
We hit a critical mass of members and got involved through on culture shows. Started singing Qawwali in, like, my senior year.
Right.
You know Qawwali?
No.
Brothers. Varun Soni has spent time with you guys, and you don't know what Qavali is? Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. You know that
name? Yeah.
All right. So Nusrat is a Qavali singer, right?
Okay. Oh.
Qavali is a tradition of Sufi mystical music.
I think you should Pakistan just sing a little for us right now.
Hell no. You know why? Because when I joined the troupe, what I had done was simply take my roommate, who was this great guy, Louis Lindo, if you're out there, shout out. Louis was, and still is, this genius of a guy. His dad is Seventh-day Adventist minister.
Mm-hmm.
Mom came from the Dominican Republic. Grew up in a family of just a lot of singing in church and whatnot in Florida, Fort Lauderdale, I think. And he came out to college, hung out. He sang a lot, but he was also deeply religious, right? We became roommates in sophomore year, just kind of hit it off, and I started playing Nusrat all the time. And he started singing it along. And then this guy is like a savant. He just started picking up. Didn't know a word of Urdu, Hindi, anything, right? No look of any kind of Desi background at all, and just started singing Qavali music. And because of the genius of his singing, a group of us just formed around him, and we started singing Qavali at random kind of Desi shows and all stuff. It was awesome. Years later, when I got married, we had a little Qavali revival at the wedding, and your man crush, friend Sonny, was there, and some others. It was good.
Well, I want to ask about.
He looks so handsome in his Indian clothes.
Oh my God,
Louis Brinsoni. Brinsoni did. That's absolutely.
While we want to talk of Daisy, I want to talk about your decision. You know, you mentioned it briefly when we were talking about the doctor hierarchy, and we're going to come back to that. There's a lot to discuss still. Was there a push or a pressure to go into a specialist or the more privileged from within the culture? And did you experience that? And can you speak to the other Desi doctors that you know?
Who've done that?
Because I'm curious, how do we... I'm still going to come back to how do we switch this system?
Yeah, gotcha.
That's where we left off, and I want to come back to that. But this feels like these are intertwined.
Absolutely. So, no, I didn't feel the pressure to do it, partly because when I made that choice to come back and go in and say I'm going to go into medicine, with my eyes kind of opened up to this idea of what social medicine was, and I was just early on in understanding that. I had the good fortune of coming back to Boston, was at Tufts Med, interned with an organization called Partners in Health. Paul Farmer founded that. Early on, met Paul Farmer and a few other mentors, and then was able to stay grounded in this broader vision, right? So having that grounding, I got my public health degree at the same time, so that grounded me in what I wanted to do. And that, plus the fact that I was always a bit of a misfit and didn't really mind that too much.
So your parents were supportive?
Parents were supportive. They were like, my kid's a doctor now, so they were cool.
Right.
But
you don't think there was an internal, like, what kind of doctor?
No, not at all. Not at all.
What about from other Desi doctors that you've been in contact with?
So early, that pressure is there. It's independent of the Desi kind of phenomenon, but it's compounded by that, right? Because of just these notions that are out there. And those notions, as we said, are kind of reinforced by financial rewards, and then the culture kind of reinforces
so
that
feel
and goes.
Like, I guess, judgment, for lack of a better word, now?
No, I don't feel any judgment at all. Okay. Even back in the day, like, if there were people who judge, but I was never affected by that, right? Because I knew my reference point was to become a doctor for something very specific, right? To be part of a community and be a change agent in that way. Right. Essentially, merge my passions in community development and political kind of understandings in the lowercase p, not like big time politics, but just thinking about what it means to bring people together and actually affect some meaningful change, have a real impact on this world. And the tool that I was going to pick up was being a doctor. That was it.
Right.
This to kind of walk that path, right? Rather than being a doctor for its own sake, like the goals were for me. Not well articulated back in the day, and still I'm figuring it out, but it was definitely not beta make a lot of money,
right?
So you can have a good 401k,
yeah,
and then you can retire nicely and have your gold plated toilet that you sit on, and then it was never all this kind of materialistic shit.
So, is that what we have to shift? Is that what? So, I'm gonna come back to this is how do we shift this system that's in place where which rewards the people at the edge of the water rather than people upstream?
So it's happening. Yeah, it's happening now. That's what's so cool about this moment. So the even before Obamacare, before the Affordable Care Act, a lot of folks who pay for healthcare, if you think about who pays for it, it's the public sector, so Medicare, Medicaid, state governments pay their own share. County governments do that as well. There's also private payers, health insurers, right? And ultimately, the majority of Americans get their insurance through employers. And the employers are paying one way or another for the health insurance that their employees get. So large employers were saying, we don't want to pay for this really low return on investment, right? Healthcare, stop giving us this really crappy outcome for an immense amount of money, right? So employers and the business sector, not the group that you would think of as the progressive leading edge of social justice policy, they were, from a value proposition, saying, we need to get a better model here because it's not working. We're paying for the wrong outcomes. The way we're paying for things is leading to the to high costs without getting better value out of it. So, you know, we are, by far, we spend 2.5 times more per person in the U.S. on health than any other nation, than our peer nations.
Do we really?
Yeah, 2.5 times more, about 8,500 or so per person.
Is that, could you chart the cause of that, because we focus so much on reactive rather than preventative?
That's exactly it. Now, if some would say, right, and I think rightly so, although they'd be entirely uninformed, that it's okay to spend that much money if we're getting really good outcomes. But the reason that's uninformed is because we're not. We are 17th or 16th when it comes to life expectancy compared to our peer nations.
Wow.
So it would be one thing if we were spending a lot of money and getting a lot of really great outcomes, but we're not. We're actually rich and poor Americans, cut across class, fare poorer in terms of health outcomes compared to our peers in other developed nations. So if you're a rich American here in the U.S. right now, you're 65 years old, made a lot of money, or you're somebody who's really poor, that's not too surprising to a lot of folks. But if you're rich or poor compared to your peers, controlling for all these other factors, we as Americans are not as healthy. So why is that, right? Why is that? And it's part of it is because of the way we've structured how we pay for stuff. Here's the way I break it down. I'm going to use a really simple kind of analogy here. Think of how we, if I gave you an example of wanting to renovate a bathroom in your home, right? You'd go out, you'd get bids from contractors, you'd say, you know, they're going to fudge it like 20-25%.
Right.
But you'd essentially say, okay, I'm going to pick this contractor, I'm going to make sure I set up the contract and keep this person accountable, and I'm going to get the value that I want, meaning a better bathroom, and it's going to look like this, this, and that, right?
Right.
That's the current kind of model for how to renovate your bathroom. But let's take the healthcare business model, which is fee-for-service, rewards, specialists, proceduralists, right? Mm-hmm. More so than anybody who's going to help you evaluate things.
Ah.
Let's take that model and to see what would happen, right? In this model, before you even knew you needed a better bathroom, someone would knock on the door and say, it's time for your checkup here. Let's do that kind of workup for your bathroom. Let's see if you need a better bathroom. Before you know it, a plumber walks in and says, I'm going to give you some new fixtures, titanium, world-class, you know, platinum fixtures right now for your faucets and stuff. And the plumber says, well, and by the way, this is the best. You need this. I'm going to charge you each time I do that because that's only appropriate, right? The interior designer comes in. He didn't know you needed one, but they come in and they start giving you all sorts of tips on, let's put a fireplace in here. Let's get some beautiful paintings. I mean, it's becoming now a really beautiful bathroom, but you didn't think you needed it. But now you're sold on the idea that you need this. And again, that designer is going to charge you every time they put that fireplace up or put that painting up or change the paint. An electrician comes up and says, I'm going to do some diagnostic testing on the wires behind the wall. Trust me, you need this. I'm going to charge you every time we do that testing, but it's good for you. And this is part of what it means to get a better bathroom, right? Eventually, contractors line up and they provide you these services that you now are convinced you need because what do you know, right, about the stuff that the electrician knows,
exactly,
the plumber. And at the end of the day, you have this beautiful, lavish bathroom, right? Fireplaces, you know, Renaissance-era paintings on the wall and marble floors and a beautiful porcelain bathtub and all these things. Again, you didn't realize you needed a better bathroom or even know that you wanted it, right? But now you have it. And you've paid for it in a way that's somewhat crazy, because what's happened is if you can afford to pay, you've been overserved intentionally, because the contractors, as well intentioned as they are, as expert as they are in their skills, they're overserving you, right? They're incented to overserve you because they're paid every time they do that
right.
service. So you're getting overserved, and there's an incentive baked in to get overcharged, right? Now, if you can't afford to pay, you're getting overcharged, but you're getting underserved, right? Think about it this way. So if no one's paying the bill anymore, then is that plumber or that electrician,
oh, right.
They're
going to
keep coming up.
No.
They're going to still overcharge you when you come in and say, look, I want to get this. I need this service. I need a better bathroom. But
right.
you're not going to get the same level of service
right.
that you need. So welcome to the American healthcare system, right? We end up with something that we defend against the Canadians and the French and anybody else who would dare question the beauty of the American healthcare system, right? We would say, this is the best damn bathroom on the block. You should
right.
see what these contractors did for me. How
sure.
dare you kind of offend my choices here? But when you go to bed at night, you realize, because of this fee-for-service kind of model, the way we've structured payments, we now have a scenario where you have an incredibly incredible looking thing that ultimately doesn't give you the value that you want. They may have forgotten to put a toilet in. You may have a porcelain. Like, in other words, there's a lot of what looks like what is beautiful or best, but it's not value, right?
So I'm hearing
the fee-for-service model is a very different model than what we would do with just contractors to build a better bathroom. And that's why the healthcare system is so much in peril right now. That's changing because now Obamacare, employers, a lot of other folks are saying, let's start paying for value, not volume. And that's what we're figuring out. In the next 6 years, based on what the federal government has said, based on what employers are thinking about, and part of what I'm so passionate about is saying, how do we take advantage of this shift to value in the way we pay for things so you get a better bathroom that makes sense?
So what rather the precipice than of a restructuring?
We're in the moment right now that is unprecedented in the past 60 years in American healthcare.
Well, I guess it's happening, but my question is, all these people that are on the side of paying less are fighting against the interests of all these people who are getting paid off of all these procedures.
That's right.
So if we are preventative and say, hey, look, you won't need a new bathroom, just do this, you're not ever going to need a new bathroom again if you take care of whatever all the time.
Right.
You are taking money out of the contractor's hands, out of the plumber's hands, out of the electrician's hands.
That's right.
How do you fight against that? In particular, when we always talk about how big medicine is such a powerful entity, lobbyists, et cetera. How do you fight against that?
Yeah. So you're absolutely right, right? There are vested interests no matter what. This is not there are those who bemoan the state of healthcare and talk about public health and then stay in that space just bemoaning it and saying, woulda, coulda, shoulda, why don't these people kind of change their ways? And I'm not one of those. I'm not naive about the fact that, in fact, this is a fight, right?
Right.
It's not about commentary, right? It's not about analysis. It's about you pick a side. The nice thing is that there are already enough stories of people who are within the people that we think of as traditionally opposed to this idea, vested interests like specialist groups and others. There are many people in those groups who actually understand that this is the right way to go and would be more than happy to get paid for doing the right thing rather than paid for its own sake.
Are they as powerful as the people who don't care about
doing right now, but that's shifting right now. And that's why we need a name for it, right? If you don't name the way forward, it's hard to imagine galvanizing people to fight for that. And that's part of why I said there are upstreamists out there. Part of what we need to do is move healthcare upstream. And then say to people, because I know this from direct experience and many thousands of clinicians and patients and communities know this, it makes total sense. It is the better standard of care. It is better professionalism to achieve a state where you've understood that somebody's coming in to the hospital because of a problem with mold in their home or because of a problem with lack of transportation. It's important for us to address that. And if we don't, you're essentially supporting a mediocre standard of care. So what I say to a lot of people who are opposed is to say, what you're defending is mediocrity.
Yeah, right? No, I think they know that. I just don't think they'd care.
Well, no, I actually think that where I think that a lot of the power is going to come from is, you know, people just saying enough is enough. And I think that there is a movement towards that because I think that for oftentimes, and it goes back to why those people would just accept whatever the person is saying to get in the bathroom is because we don't know better. You know what I mean? When it comes to healthcare, it's such a terrifying thing because it's our body and it's such a vulnerable place to be in that you're more apt to say yes.
That's right.
At least I am. That's been my experience with healthcare.
That's right.
And so now, but when you frame it, and as you framed it with the story of that young lady who came in, I think her name was Veronica, when she came into the, and when you framed it like this, they went to the ER and she kept getting, I think she even got a spinal tap for headaches.
Yeah.
And like how many tests she had gone through over like the month or two or whatever that time frame was until she came and met you guys at the clinic.
Yep.
And the first question was just, where do you live? And what do you, to me, like that I understand, like that frames in a way that I can understand and I can say, yeah, that's the kind of healthcare I want.
Yep.
And people, I think that people don't understand they have a choice. I think people aren't like, they just, I think it's the most vulnerable sector and it's the most ripe to, I mean, people talk about car mechanics as a place to, I mean, a lot of doctors are doing just as horrible things and it's unconscionable to me, but it does happen and it, you know.
Yeah. So there, you know, amen, right? I agree with you. I think that, let me unpack this and I agree, right? There is a challenge in how we think through the role of patients right now and providers and all this. Here's what's happening in my sense of where we are right now. And I'm not saying this is, everything's copacetic right now. Like we're all set. the future is clear, right? I think this is a moment of choice. And this is unlike, though, the moments even 6-10 years ago where there was really no choice. Patients had to do this stuff. But you have now shifting power dynamics. You have patients who have more access to information, who are also advocating for themselves. So patient empowerment, patient voice is, in this era right now, driven by access to information and everything that we know. Patients' voices are rising up. So patients' power is increasing. You think about the payers who are out there, not the providers, especially the specialists and the vested interests, but the payers. Payers are starting to say, again, we're no longer willing to accept the terms of this contract.
Would that be the employers that you were referring to?
The employers who pay for the insurance.
That's right. And specifically self-insured employers, for those who want to wonk out on this, right? Self-insured employers in the U.S. right now, representing almost half of employers at this point in time in the U.S., they are the ones who are probably most exposed to the financial perils of a broken healthcare payment system. And they're the ones who are starting to exert their own power to say enough. A couple months ago, 20 of the nation's largest companies, IBM and a few other, and many others, came together and they said, you know what, we're actually going to cut out the insurance companies. We're going to directly negotiate right now these providers because we don't accept the terms of the game anymore. We actually want to get more value out of this. 4 million lives represented by those 20 companies, right?
Wow.
Things are changing right now. People are exerting power. The payers are starting to say, we want to have more of a stake in the game. Patients are certainly doing this independently and also in larger kind of organized groups. And then providers, within the provider community, there are many providers who are stepping up. There's a story I'll kind of, it's not hopeless at all, right? You have in this book I wrote before the TED Talk, I told the story of a guy I learned about in Maryland, a trauma surgeon. Someone you would think would be the classic definition of a specialist who would have no interest in a move towards prevention. This trauma surgeon was spending his time in Maryland, in Baltimore, taking care of a lot of gunshot wound victims. Many of those who would perish, die in the operating room. Those who would survive, he'd patch up, take the bullets out. They'd recover, they'd go back into the communities that they lived in, experience the same risks for violence, and they'd come back in again, right? And he'd see them, the very same people that he had just helped save days, weeks, months earlier, back on his operating room. So he was fed up. He's like, there's something wrong about this. It's not just, it's not about value, money, or anything. It's just not what the profession that he had signed up for as a surgeon could abide by, right? He couldn't abide by it. So driven by that professionalism and that sense of, frankly, the oath, right? Do no harm. He said, well, why don't we figure out a different solution? And he got some social workers together in the hospital. He got a grant, and he went out and supported those who were the gunshot wound victim survivors. They recover, they go back into their communities, and those support services, the social worker and others, would get that person connected to the resources they needed, minimize the risks of getting back into gang life
being
or whatever it is, right?
Right.
83% reduction in the recidivism,
right,
of people coming back in among the survivors there.
Right.
This is a trauma surgeon who is a definition of an upstreamist in thought, right? You don't have to be a primary care person or even a public health person to be an upstreamist.
Interesting.
An upstreamist is someone who has this orientation, who has the skills, and also the requisite authority and system in the system that they work in, right? In a clinic, a hospital like that one. Somebody who essentially says, we need to start to just do something simple, not just for one person at a time, but for everybody that comes through our doors. Let's routinely ask about what matters where people live and work, and let's make sure that we get the resources they need so that we're just making our jobs easier so that we can do the right things. It doesn't make sense for me to spend my time as a trauma surgeon taking care of all these people. Now the 83% reduction in people ending up in the OR bay represents better professional satisfaction, better outcomes, obviously. But if you think about it, for the hospital, it represents now unused space that they could fill in with other people who need that care. The problem is, so the trauma surgeon can be an upstreamist. In other words, the people who are in the provider community are themselves starting to say there is something wrong, like your dad was saying, right, about having to see 30 to 40 people when you're not saying anything about are they getting better, right? Mm-hmm. People are starting to exert, providers are now pushing against some of the confines of the organized medical establishment, right, that represented them and saying enough is enough. So people are exerting power in ways that has not been seen in the past 60 years. It was seen when Medicare and Medicaid put on the table, right? It was seen in the war on poverty. We saw it again in the mid-70s through an expansion of some primary care opportunities, something called the National Health Service Corps was put in. history is important here because we're actually in this moment right now where change has already happened and is happening at a pace, like I said. Last 6 years have seen more change in healthcare than we've seen in the past 60 years.
Wow.
And not since Medicare and Medicaid. History is important for us because it's not just those in healthcare, doctors and others who care about this. This is actually for all of us.
I know that feels a little bit like an abrupt ending, and it kind of is, and I apologize, but we had to do something unorthodox this week because we just realized that we had recorded twice as much content as we normally do with our guests, and in order for what we felt like the best way for you guys to be able to digest and process everything that we put it that we recorded, we wanted to split the episode up. So we will drop part two next week, so definitely come in to tune it in, check it out. Akash is in Italy, so I got to do this whole thing by myself right now. I want to thank you all for listening. Rate the podcast, review the podcast, share our Facebook post that we put out there. Also, we're going to have a question out there in the Facebook post, so if you get a chance to listen in and write something up, that'd be great. I'm Arjun, and for Akash, God bless.